Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All right, buckle up. A Daily Mail reporting that Trump will not be arraigned this week, but he is expected to be indicted today. Mm-hmm. Secret Service will make plans for his surrender and appearance in New York to get fingerprinted and his picture taken.
A little mugshot. Christmas card material, you call
that
it.
That will happen. That will happen next week.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Next Wednesday.
And then in Manhattan today, what a circus that is going to be when this comes down, if the reports are accurate. All 36, I mean, even the reporting on it, it's to hype this event like it's a sporting event.
Right.
All 36,000 NYPD officers are in uniform and on notice for deployment after Trump called for his supporters to protest his imminent indictment.
And they put up barricades everywhere and they fixed the, you know, the street cameras to make sure they got the action so they could get the perpetrators on tape. I mean, relax. And I have to tell you, there was a planned protest two nights ago, Dan. 20 people showed up. So I think, you know, when others like McCarthy and other Republicans are saying, you know, just stay home, I think people are going to stay home. I don't know, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Do you know anyone that's going to head out there to Manhattan to fight for Trump, to fight for freedom?
I don't know what that means. I mean, I'm fine.
Protest?
That's just like the silly Beltway narrative, counting protesters or... calling for
wants.
Protests or calling for
well, that's what Trump
for
did.
Protesters to stay home. Oh. And it's just so who cares? I don't know if 100 people show up and protest for Trump and then 100 other people show up with arrest Trump signs. It's whatever. It's we do that with every issue. So what?
Yeah, but they're going to blow it out of the water and they're going to make them look worse than the situation. They, meaning the media. They want this. They're foaming at the mouth for this. They want people to show up.
It doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter. I mean, well, yeah, so they need the ratings. So they want to whip frenzy. Okay, fine. But I mean, they've already called all Trump voters insurrectionists. They've already repeatedly referred to people who may lean center right and may show up to a school board meeting to challenge a school board decision or domestic terrorists. I mean, what more do you want to do in terms of name calling or branding? They do that with everything. So whatever your decision is, however you want to receive the indictment of the former president, again, assuming this comes to pass, we've been postponed before. Don't do it based on how the media is going to brand you, what the media is going to say. We're always in the center right, with the exception of Trump and a few others, but one of the appeals of Trump, always back on our hind legs. What are people going to think? What are people going to say? Why don't you just make the argument that you want to make about whatever issue you want to address and not worry about living your life in the minds of the D.C. press corps. How stupid is that?
Well, it's not stupid, Dan, when a realtor from Chicago goes on January 6th and hangs outside the Capitol, didn't even go in, and she gets fired from her job. I mean, there are consequences. There were people that were attacked for even just showing up to exercise their freedom of speech. So I don't want that to happen to people again. But if they want to do it, go ahead. I'm just saying this is not like a normal protester. These people, Trump supporters
don't
are not.
Don't do it, but if you want to do
no,
it,
I mean,
do
I can't
it.
Tell
yeah,
people
that's
what to do.
Point.
I'm just saying that's how stupid January 6th was at times when people lost their livelihoods over it. And one woman was inside for 2 minutes and she spent 3 days in jail and she's dying of cancer. She's in her 80s. Come on.
I'm not sure I understand what your point is. That that people have been mistreated, that people have been wrongly defamed right. by the press corps, that people are victims of cowardice in corporate America. Yeah, I know. We talk about that a lot in this show.
And if they go to New York again, it's going to happen to them again.
So what is your reaction? Your reaction is to say, don't go, but go if you want to. What is that? What's your position?
My position is do not go. Don't feed in. Don't give them what they want. They want this. They, meaning the Democrats, they need it. Then same with the left-wing media. They need it. Don't help them. That's why I'm glad only 20 people showed up. And mostly people that are showing up are wearing, did you see they said with the woman, or I don't even know what that was, a black person who was half naked with a Trump mask on, had a rope around the neck with a sign behind it, arrest Trump. Creepy.
Oh, right.
This is freak show, a horror show.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. So the underlying issue about people being mislabeled as domestic terrorists, about people losing their jobs if they're pictured at the wrong place at the wrong time, even if they've done nothing wrong, nothing illegal. I'm sorry. Your solution to that is what? Silence forever?
No, not silence forever.
Just show up on election day? Yeah. What's your solution?
Vote. I don't know. Vote. You want Trump right. in office? Vote. You want to support Trump?
I'm so passionate about you doing something or doing nothing, but don't do anything and just show up and vote, and that should be enough.
I don't know what else to do at this
point. What fantasy world do you live in? Philip in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Go easy on Amy this morning, please, Dan. The whole thing is Trump is the one who... He's always inciting these things. First of all, they're
inciting
now,
them. I'm sorry. Who is bringing the charges? How is he inciting them? Who is bringing this ridiculous case?
It's ridiculous, but yeah, he's the one who ridiculously cheated on his wife and paid Stormy Daniels to keep it from the public. Yeah. But he's lying again, and then he got on the plane and lied.
I'm sorry, Philip. Lying is not illegal. I'm not saying it's laudatory. I'm not saying cheating your wife is laudatory. I'm saying it's not illegal. We're talking about a legal matter. And we're talking about a former president, too, by the way. So who is instigating this? You just said it's a dumb case. It's a dumb case. Right. So who's the instigator?
Well, I mean,
Alvin Bragg?
When Trump comes out and says, I'm going to be indicted, which he hasn't been indicted yet. He's supposed to have been a couple of days ago now. And then he says, protest. He's asking for this. It's not the press that put out where Trump is going to be indicted. You all need to protest. That wasn't he's using the media to try to push his own narrative. And now you want to blame the media for covering it?
I don't see how that works. No. Let me tell you how it works.
Come on.
It is not the media covering it. It's, follow along, how the media covers it. It's not the media covering school board meetings. It's the media characterizing parents who disagree with a school board decision as domestic terrorists. It's the National Association of School Boards writing to DOJ characterizing parents as domestic terrorists to get the DOJ involved in some sort of watchdog capacity at school board meetings. It's characterizing everyone who was present on January 6th, and not to mention the 70 million people who voted for Trump, as all sort of insurrectionists or insurrectionist adjacent. It's how you cover unfairly to inflame and divide and instigate violence, not that you cover. You understand that versus how?
I do, but I think Trump is also a master of manipulating the media.
Well, of course, yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I know. Of course, he's going to use the media for his benefit. He's going to make a bigger spectacle of this than even Alvin Bragg has. Of course he is.
But not only for political reasons.
But what the media says, if Trump says protest.
Yeah, protest, exclamation point, all in large caps. Take back America.
If that necessarily means violence because you use an exclamation point, I don't think so. And
take back America.
He said we must save America. Protest.
Yeah. Save America, Take Back America. This is like conventional political talk, by the way, especially for, essentially a challenger, which Trump is right now. Take back our state, take back our schools, take back our country. It's said by both sides. But when Trump says it, it's an insurrection. It's an effort. It's a conspiracy to overthrow the federal government. It's so absurd.
So
I'm just tired
of
indulging the absurdity. But go ahead.
I remember Clinton being impeached for saying that he didn't know Monica Lewinsky. And I remember Trump saying that he didn't know Stormy Daniels.
No,
he
didn't know.
He said he couldn't remember.
No, Bill Clinton got impeached. Bill Clinton lied under oath.
Yeah, he said he did not have sexual relations with that woman did have sexual relations with that woman.
I assume that you were cheering on people who are being prosecuted for process crimes like lying to the FBI in Trump world. You're complaining about Bill Clinton. It wasn't because Bill Clinton had Monica in the Oval Office. It was because he lied under oath.
The cover up was worse than the crime.
I'm sorry. I was just making a comparison, but it seems to be like everything that Trump does, and I think campaign finance violations is a crime. I believe it's a crime, right?
Except the FEC has chose not to pursue the case, just like the U.S. Attorney's Office chose not to pursue the case, just like the Manhattan DA before Alvin Bragg chose not to pursue the case. And you've had former FEC Chairman Bradley Smith weigh in to say that payment, even if it is as the left would characterize it, hush money payment for Stormy Daniels to not say anything embarrassing, it is not a campaign finance violation. So except for all that, yeah, okay. This is exactly what was said yesterday by Neil Gorsuch's former clerk. What you have is a bogus legal theory, a stripper, and a disbarred attorney, and that's what you're going to use to prosecute a former president. Good luck with that. Thanks for the call, Phil.
Hello?
George, Naperville.
Dan, if you support Trump, you should stay in your basement like Biden did when he was running for president.
All right.
Well, are you going to go to New York? Where'd Tough Guy go? Where is he not on the line?
Who's Tough Guy?
I'm just saying, is he going to go to New York? Is anybody going to go to New York to fight for Trump? Or to protest, like he asked you all to do on True Social.
Well, I don't think you have to book a ticket to Manhattan. I think you can do it where you live. I think you can do it on social media. There's a lot of ways in the 21st century to lodge your opinion and pledge your support. Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Did Philip call out Maxine Waters when she said to get in their face, everybody's face? Then he's being fair. If he did,
what is no justice, no peace? What are the chance of Black Lives Matter in the streets of America's major cities? I mean, I don't care what your chance are, per se. But I mean, everything Trump says is like it's a veiled call for
insurrection and everything.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Sad.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There's another Trump legal matter that has an update. ABC News reporting yesterday that prosecutors in the special counsel's office have presented compelling preliminary evidence that Trump knowingly and deliberately misled his own attorneys about his retention of classified materials. A former top federal judge wrote in Friday in a sealed filing, according to sources who described the contents to ABC News. Well, what is going on there? How is there a leak in the special counsel's office? Oh, here we go again. Mueller investigation 2.0. We're going to purposely leak what's going on in the special counsel's office to try the case in the public arena and build public support for a prosecution in advance of a prosecution. Or at least we're going to use leaking materials to trial balloon whether or not we should actually move forward with this case. Can we sell it? Not is it an enforcement action, not is it an equal application of the law. I mean, given everything we know about the handling of classified information by politicians in the wake of the raid in Mar-a-Lago. But can we get the American people to swallow it? Or maybe can we use this as an opportunity to foment more discord, political discord in advance of 2024? Leaks coming out of the special counsel's office, not a trivial matter, and it wasn't when it was Mueller's investigation either. And look how that worked out over many years and daily lies from the left and all their mouthpieces, Schiff and company. And so now they're going to drag this on in the same manner. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. That's something that should be part of the pushback from the Republican Party writ large, Trump or no Trump. By the way, on Truth Social yesterday, the former president took the opportunity of the news of his imminent indictment to offer a bit of a retrospective on the last 7 years. Yes, 7 years of accusations and investigations from every quarter of the left.
These four horrible radical left Democrat investigations of your all-time favorite president, me, is just a continuation of the most disgusting witch hunt in the history of our country. It's gone on forever with Russia, 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 and Ukraine, 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 and the Mueller hoax. It's an absolute disgrace what's going on. They even spied on my campaign. And remember this, with all of the work that they did on Mueller, no collusion. That's what the answer was all no collusion. Whether it's the Mar-a-Lago raid or the Unselect Committee hoax, the perfect Georgia phone call, it was absolutely perfect, or the Stormy Horseface Daniels extortion plot. They're all sick, and it's fake news. Our enemies are desperate to stop us because they know that we are the only ones who can stop them, and they know it very strongly. And they're looking at the polls where, not me, but we are up by so much. They can't even believe it. We won twice, and now we've got to win a third time. They know that we can defeat them. They know that we will defeat them. But they're not coming after me. They're coming after you. I'm just standing in their way, and I always will stand in their way. Thank you very much.
Classic Trump right there. Like him or lump him, that's classic Trump.
It's just hard for me to process it. You know, this Bragg has been so soft on crime, and since he's taken office, he has downgraded 52% of felony cases to misdemeanors. Yet this case, you know, he's going after full throttle. And it's because in New York, Dan, you can rob somebody, point a gun at their face, not injure them, and get a misdemeanor now. That's been happening since he's been in office. As long as nobody's hurt or shot, it's okay. It's a misdemeanor, and then you can go home hours later. Maybe do it all over again, too.
This question about Trump. Assuming he gets indicted, mm-hmm. Now let's assume he gets convicted. Oh, let's assume he gets convicted of a felony.
Okay.
because that's what he'll be charged
with.
Find
a juror of his peers.
let's assume he gets convicted of multiple felonies. Assume he gets convicted in Manhattan. Assume he gets convicted of mishandling of classified information. How does that impact your support of his candidacy for president? Because he's still going to be running.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you can be convicted of a felony and still run for president of the United States. There's no bar on that. How does that impact your support for Trump? Does it harden it? Or do you say, well, we can't have a convicted felon as the nominee of the Republican Party? We can't have a convicted felon in the White House. That will be too much baggage for him to carry across the finish line come 2024 against Biden or whoever. So at that point, if he's convicted, we have to go with DeSantis, for example. What's your view on that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Roger, Southside.
Hi. Just to your last statement, Dan, I think anybody who's been indicted or by anybody on the left over the last 3 years, it should be a badge of honor. I mean, the list is endless. On and on and on. I mean, and to Amy, what you said before, Dan chimed in, what part of this is hard for you to understand? You live in Chicago. If you don't understand in barnyard politics and animal farm kingdom lifestyle, I don't know. You must have been missing something all the years you've been here. Because, I mean, that's all this is. So here's what's going to happen. The people who, the middle class that pull the ship every day for years upon years, decades upon decades. Okay, well, I have news for you, including people like me. We're not going to live on our knees. We've never had to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an old football coach used to say to me, Dan, we need somebody to make a sacrifice. Okay, it's going to come to that. If they think that, oh, what the Clintons have done over the years and all their dark ops, or clowns, believe me, you've got 80 million people who are very capable out here. In Illinois and Chicago as well, who, you know what, believe me, they're not going to take a step backwards. They're waiting. And the quietest guy in the room is the most dangerous one. So, you know, I mean, do you understand that? What part of barnyard politics don't you understand? You've got Tony Preckwinkle, who's destroyed an entire state here. I mean, you want to talk about sloth. You want to talk about useless. I mean, what part
of... She and Kim Fox together, yeah.
Okay, listen. Why do you think that somebody like Soros or the powers that be put dumb female African-Americans in these spots? Because they you know why? It's a very easy... It's a short jump to show... You know what I'm saying? And they could also say, well, you know, it's not racial. I mean, why is it hard to understand? Kim Fox has been in her office three times. Three. Okay, since she was last reelected. Three times she has been in her office.
She's working remotely.
It was because of COVID. COVID's almost over, May 11th.
And she's got to make sure that her husband stays away from the video game console. Thanks for the call, Roger. I get it. No, but I mean, the point is the living on your knees piece. I mean, that's the point. You think you can appease these people?
No.
You think if you are silent, then they will...
just go away?
They'll retreat? Yeah, no. Yeah. That's what they want. I mean, and by the way, the persecution of Trump here, it's not the only persecution that's happening. Another trial that's underway, although it's on pause over some assertion of witness intimidation, I guess. But the trial of Douglas Mackey, a.k.a. Ricky Vaughn, the memester that we talked about before. This is the guy who's being prosecuted by the federal government under an 1871 law that was erected to eradicate the Ku Klux Klan. And their intimidation at and polling places and so forth. For a meme that he posted in the 2016 campaign.
Showing what?
There's this fake meme that he, I mean, it's a real meme, but it's obviously fake news here.
Right.
He posted a meme, avoid the line, vote from home, text Hillary to 59925, vote for Hillary and be a part of history. Hashtag I'm with her, go Hillary. This has been cast by the Department of Justice as conspiring to deprive people of their right to vote.
It's a meme.
In addition to, and he did, like, you know, tweets and text messages. Conspiring to deprive people of their right to vote. I mean, this is, like, a really important First Amendment case.
Yeah. Well, they had to dig deep for 1871. I'm sure they didn't have social media back then.
Conspiring with others to advance, in advance of the 2016, to use various social media platforms to disseminate information designed to deprive individuals of their constitutional right to vote. That's what the DOJ is charging this young dude with for his misinformation campaign against Hillary.
I saw that meme. I remember seeing that meme and thinking that was funny and just moving on.
Right, because you understand you can't text your vote in.
Exactly. Hello.
Apparently, the Department of Justice has a very low opinion of Hillary Clinton voters because this was a grand conspiracy to deprive them of the right to vote because they are that dupable, I suppose.
Do they have any records of people who tried it? I mean, who cares? They should know you can't vote.
Well,
by
right.
Text.
I mean, this is the point. It could have been as many as this many people that were deprived of their right to vote because that's how many text messages he sends out. That's sort of non-evidence to buttress their case. I mean, you understand the implications of this, even if you don't like this. And he's like, "Oh, well, that's silly, and don't do that," and that's fine. You're entitled to that opinion. You understand that if he is prosecuted, that sets a precedent if he's successfully prosecuted and convicted and if the conviction not overturned, that would set a precedent where the federal government could go after anybody for anything they deem inaccurate as conspiring to deprive someone of their right to vote because you said something about a candidate, you said something about the particulars of Election Day that was inaccurate. Well, that's the end of your right to express yourself.
Yep.
And very few people are talking about this. By the way, also, the way the government is going after this guy, his attorney was on Tucker Carlson's show last night, and he was saying that the government has a confidential source that he is not allowed to cross-examine. Well, you have a right to face your accuser.
Sixth Amendment.
The government can't be. I mean, it's all this government action too, which is a whole nother topic from the questions about FBI involvement to January 6th and the dubious law enforcement action against the people who conspired to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer. This Douglas Mackey stuff, this what confidential source, and that the defense can't know, can't cross examine.
No way.
And this also goes to what George Perry, former federal prosecutor of Pennsylvania, federal and state prosecutor we had on yesterday, said. You know, where are the judges here? How are you letting the federal government get away with this? The Department of Justice, are you a separate branch? I mean, where are the mechanisms of accountability, which is a constant question, lament? This is some bad business here, I got to tell you. And all of this happened concurrently. And that we're against the backdrop of reports of another 1,000 people are going to be rounded up by the DOJ for whatever they may or may not have done on January 6th.
It's over. Leave them alone. And stop holding the people in jail as political prisoners.
Chuck Delavan, Wisconsin.
When a Molotov drops, who do you trust? The guy who was just on the phone, he said, the most dangerous man in the room is the guy that's quiet. If you're not hooked up with a group, if you don't have a group of people, that know what's going on. The biggest problem the January 6th guys did, they didn't burn the city like they did in Minneapolis. They didn't burn the city like they did in Kenosha. You go on YouTube and you can see the people that burnt the 100 cars in a parking lot. Not one guy is on fire. If they don't think that the 80 million people that voted for Trump does not see there's a difference here, they're a little bit messed up. So thank you very much for letting me talk.
All right, Chuck, thanks. Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Hey, good morning, all. I agree with Chuck there in some ways. I'm all for Trump, you know, and if anything is good for Washington, it's not good for us out here. I mean, it's just whatever they say, it's the exact opposite is what's better for us. They consistently work against us time and time again. And they couldn't care less. And the caller before that said was talking about, you know, Soros installing this person and that person. It still takes the people that have to vote for them.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, people, yeah, I mean, they, you know, Soros can stay and spend money all he wants and Pritzker and all he wants. But if the people come out and vote for what's best for themselves, which is the opposite of what Washington and the federal government is telling us, then these people won't be in office. So people have to wake up and get their ass off their chairs and the couches and come out and vote what's best for them.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Given this PBS documentary on Tony Fauci, apparently followed him around for the better part of 2 years in 20 and 21, maybe into 22. We talked about it a bit yesterday, some of the clips that have surfaced. Him wandering around D.C. neighborhoods with D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. But
it's unbelievable.
Given the politicization of science when it came to the response to COVID, and given the politicization of science when it comes to everything under the rubric green energy and climate change, these, you know, all these existential threats. A friend of mine prompted me to revisit Michael Crichton. Michael Crichton was the great sci-fi techno-thriller author.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Yes.
You may know him from such books as Jurassic Park, for example. The Andromeda Strain, obviously several of his novels were optioned into movies. But Crichton also had an MD from Harvard. He didn't practice medicine, but he had a medical degree from Harvard.
I did not know that.
Sharp guy, and particularly in this space of science and biotech, and obviously a fertile mind with all of his successful novels. And about 4 years before he died, he wrote a book called State of Fear. And the appendix in State of Fear, now this is 20 years ago, the appendix in State of Fear, see if some of the passages not only were prescient, but couldn't be more relevant to the conversations we're having today. He writes in Appendix to State of Fear, imagine there's a new scientific theory that warns of an impending crisis and points to a way out. This theory quickly draws support from leading scientists, politicians, and celebrities around the world. Research is funded by distinguished philanthropies and carried out at prestigious universities. The crisis is reported frequently in the media. The science is taught in college and high school classrooms. Its supporters included Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Winston Churchill. It was approved by Supreme Court Justices Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis, who ruled in its favor. Famous names who supported it included, and there's a giveaway here, included Alexander Graham Bell, Margaret Sanger, Luther botanist Luther Burbank, Leland Stanford, founder of Stanford University, H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw. Nobel Prize winners gave support. Research was backed by the Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations. These efforts had the support of the National Academy of Sciences, the American Medical Association, the National Research Council. It was said that if Jesus were alive, he would have supported this effort. All in all, the research, legislation, and molding of public opinion surrounding the theory went on for almost half a century. Those who opposed the theory were shouted down and called reactionary, blind to reality, or just plain ignorant. In hindsight, what is surprising is so few people objected. The theory was eugenics. And its history is so dreadful, writes Crichton, and to those who were caught up in it, so embarrassing, that it is now rarely discussed. Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood.
Yeah,
Planned Parenthood, wonderful organization.
Black neighborhoods, predominantly.
But as Crichton writes, it's a story that should be well known to every citizen so that its horrors are not repeated. Sorry, Michael. We went the other way. We don't, as a people, don't know much about much. Just as a refresher, in case people are unfamiliar with or have forgotten just how barbaric this popularized, widely accepted theory was and is, the eugenics postulated a crisis of the gene pool leading to the deterioration of the human race. The best human beings were not breeding as rapidly as the inferior ones. The foreigners, immigrants, Jews, degenerates, the unfit, the feeble-minded.
Oh, boy.
This was the theory.
Right.
This is the founder of Planned Parenthood and so many others of the era. This theory, as Crichton writes, goes on, they were adopted, these theories, by science-minded Americans. Dangerous human pests, quote unquote, the rising tide of imbeciles, quote unquote, were polluting the best of the human race. The eugenicists and the immigrationists joined forces to put a stop to this. The plan was to identify individuals who were feeble-minded. Jews were agreed to be largely feeble-minded, but so were many foreigners, as well as blacks, and stop them from breeding by isolation in institutions and by sterilization. Margaret Sanger, quote, fostering the good for nothing at the expense of the good is extreme cruelty. There's no greater curse to posterity than to bequeathing them an increasing population of imbeciles. She spoke of the burden of caring for, quote, this dead weight of human waste, unquote. Put your pea hat and your Planned Parenthood t-shirt on when you go out to the Starbucks there in Hinsdale. H.G. Wells spoke against, quote, ill-trained swarms of inferior citizens. There was overt racism in this movement, obviously, as Crichton writes, exemplified by texts such as The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy by American author Lothrop Stoddard. But at the same time, racism was considered an unremarkable aspect of the effort to attain a marvelous goal, the improvement of humankind in the future. They're saving the planet.
Right. Global warming starts early. Their version of it. And we need fewer people, and we only want to keep the good ones, Dan.
I think we understand what happened when this was exported. this noxious idea and the body count associated with it. Another example. Soviet Union. Trofim Lysenko, a self-promoting peasant who solved the problem of fertilizing the fields without fertilizers and minerals. What? In 1928, he claimed to have invented a procedure called vernalization, this is Crichton writing from the appendix in State of Fear, by which seeds were moistened and chilled to enhance the later growth of crops. Lysenko's methods never faced a rigorous test, but his claim that his treated seeds passed on their characteristics to the next generation represented a revival of previously debunked botanist at a time when the rest of the world was embracing Mendelian genetics. Stalin, drawn to Lysenko because it implied a future unbounded by hereditary constraints when it came to crop production. He wanted improved agricultural production. Lysenko promised both. He became the darling of the Soviet media and was on the lookout for stories about clever peasants who had developed revolutionary procedures. Lysenko was portrayed as a genius, milked the celebrity for all it was worth. He was especially skillful at denouncing his opponents. He used questionnaires from farmers to prove that vernalization increased crop yields so he could avoid any direct tests. Carried on a wave of state-sponsored enthusiasm, his rise was rapid. By 1937, he was a member of the Supreme Soviet governing body of the Soviet Union. Lysenko and his theories dominated Russian biology. The result? Famines that killed millions and purges that sent hundreds of dissenting Soviet scientists to the gulags or the firing squads. Crichton, writing in 2004, well, that's when the book was published, wrote this prior, obviously, 20 years ago plus. Now we are engaged in a great new theory that once again has drawn the support of politicians, scientists, and celebrities around the world. Once again, the theory is promoted by major foundations. Once again, the research is carried out at prestigious universities. Once again, legislation is passed, and social programs are urged in its name. Please see the Green New Deal. My little insertion. Once again, critics are few and harshly dealt with. Right? Flat earthers. Once again, the measures being urged have little basis in fact or science. Once again, groups with other agendas are hiding behind a movement that appears high-minded. Saving the planet. What could be higher? Once again, claims of moral superiority are used to justify extreme actions. Once again, the fact that some people are hurt is shrugged off because an abstract cause is said to be greater than any human consequences. Once again, vague terms like sustainability and generational justice are employed in the service of the new crisis. Crichton continued, I'm not arguing global warming is the same as eugenics, but the similarities are not superficial. And I do claim that open and frank discussion of the data and of the issues is being suppressed. Leading scientific journals have taken strong editorial positions on the side of global warming, which I argue they have no business doing. Under the circumstances, any scientist who has doubts understands clearly that they will be wise to mute their expression. The past of human belief is a cautionary tale. We have killed thousands of our fellow human beings because we believe they had signed a contract with the devil and had become witches. We still kill more than 1,000 people each year for witchcraft. In my view, there's only one hope for humankind to emerge from what Carl Sagan called the demon-haunted world of our past, the hope of science. But when the search for truth is confused with political advocacy, the pursuit of knowledge is reduced to the quest for power, which is a quote from Alston Chase, and that's where we are now. Oh, and I was prompted by that to revisit that appendix because this just in, the University of Helsinki is conferring an honorary doctorate
to who?
Greta Thunberg.
Oh,
she's a high school dropout who is getting an honorary doctorate from the Faculty of Theology.
Theology? Huh. Thought maybe environmental science. All right, theology. That's interesting.
Mother Gaia.
Oh, that's right.
It's a religion, don't you know? High school dropout, Greta Thunberg, celebrity, modern day Lysenko. John in Lincolnwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy. I am. I have to say, I'm so happy, Dan, that you have brought this book up. I read it when it first came out. It's one of my favorite authors. I have pushed it on people. I bought it for people. I've told people about it. And I, you know, I get laughed off, told, oh, it's the dinosaur writer or whatever.
Yeah, right, right. He's right. Just somebody who makes stuff up. He doesn't know anything. Right, sure.
Exactly. And then when I tell them his credentials, because he's one of my favorite authors, and I've read every one of his books, and I tell them, take it seriously, because what he writes in the book and in the appendix is happening, and it's extremely scary, because it's so accurate that it is scary, the book. And then when COVID first hit, I called your show, and I believe I talked to Amy, and I'm not sure if you were there, Dan. I said, please read this book. Please push the book.
You did.
It was very important, because if people would just take the time, even audiobook or whatever, just take the time and just listen, more and more people would be a lot better off than they are now. And thank you, Dan, I really appreciate you bringing up this book.
Thanks for the call, John. Well, I mean, and the other thing, too, is just whether you agree with Michael Crichton's comparisons or not, the history that he recounts in that appendix is irrefutable. So at minimum, think about that history and ask yourself if we're invulnerable from repeating it. The people that are so sure, so willing to take whatever line your fellow travelers offer about COVID or climate change or anything else, and cast the other side as the feeble-minded that need to be eradicated. I was watching a clip yesterday, Tucker Carlson. I had never seen this clip before because I don't watch Bill Maher's show, but he was talking about Jan 6 because he had the QAnon shaman's mom and his attorney on.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I did see that.
And there's a clip from one of these ghouls from the Lincoln Project, Steve Schmidt, and one of the good Republicans trying to save the Republican Party, except no, he's I'm a leftist, and I'm also an aider and abettor of a sexual predator.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
They used to head up the Lincoln Project.
Yeah, how did that end for that guy?
But it was from a episode of the Bill Maher Show where Schmidt was on, and it was the video that we just saw at the time of the QAnon shaman, but it's still him walking down a hallway. It was a hallway he probably shouldn't have been in, but he wasn't attacking anybody, even though he had a Viking helmet on. It's odd. I concur. He shouldn't have been in the house floor and so on and so forth. But there was no violence. And Schmidt called for the QAnon shaman. You see, he walked by a Capitol Police officer who had his gun holstered. And I was like, shoot him, shoot him. What? You can't believe that these sorts of things can happen. You can't believe that a psychosis can take over and lead a mob to do horrible things. And Michael Crichton's, based on politicized science, that becomes ideological, and people's like reason for existence or their basis upon which they say they're a good person. You can't believe the horrors that people will commit in furtherance of that delusion. And Crichton in that appendix just reminds us of the history. And by the way, we saw a lot of that. not to the extent of the eugenics movement or even, obviously, Stalin's Soviet Union, but we saw a lot of inhumanity.
During COVID. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was horrible. The way we treated each other. And the way, mistreatment, people being denied organ transplants. And even still to this day, because they're not vaccinated for a vaccine that is not as efficient and effective as we were told because it was a lie per Dr. Fauci. But back to that caller who said, you remember when he said he did come on the show and talked about Michael Crichton, and then somebody else called in and said, read George Orwell's 1984. And I have the book, and I started reading, and I couldn't read it because it was too much like real life at that time that we were experiencing.
Clay and Wheeling.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, I guess this question is more for you. Didn't Sweden carry their eugenics program all the way into, like, the mid-70s? I believe they did, and then silently dropped it off the books. But I digress. Anybody who says that they're going to, quote-unquote, save the world or, quote-unquote, save humanity, you know that person's probably full of it, and you should be very careful about what they say. But also watch what they're investing in, because they're probably going to make money on it, and so will you then. It's o facto Al Gore. I mean, that guy's made millions off of one of the greatest lies of all time.
Yeah, it's his job. Yeah, it's his livelihood.
Yeah,
that's why. He
my advice is just invest in what these people invest in, and then, you know, just copy along and then just chop it off. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Yeah, Sweden did that until 1975.
Yeah, forced sterilization.
Forced sterilization without valid consent of the subject.
Yeah.
At the time. Yeah, that's nice.
And the vestiges of eugenics live on, dare I repeat myself, but I will, in Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm. Celebrated by the left.
when an idea takes hold. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Is your pantry organized? Is your pantry at home tidy? You know, in your kitchen.
Okay.
Your pantry.
So you've got your spice drawer, you got the spice or spice rack, and during the pandemic, I cleaned and organized my spice drawer and my pantry. I clean it, but then boom, it's like a used minivan. It's never really clean, even when you clean it. So now it's all chaotic and Peyton comes home tonight. So it's going to be like a hurricane went through there. So no, it's not organized.
All right. Well, good, because that means you're not racist.
Oh, I'm not?
No.
Can I put that on my Christmas card?
Here in Chicago, Loyola University Associate Professor of Marketing, Jenna Drenton.
Yeah.
Loyola's very own.
Good Catholics.
She has noticed a uptick on social media in pantry porn.
Oh, now we have to worry about pantry porn. Justin, are you listening? Okay.
Where women show off their fully stocked kitchen and their organized home supplies.
Oh, good for
Historically,
them.
According to Professor quotation marks, Drenton, tidiness is intertwined with status, and a person's messiness often breeds assumptions about a person's capacity to be responsible and respectable. She writes, cleanliness has historically been used as a cultural gatekeeping mechanism to reinforce status distinctions based on a vague understanding of niceness. Nice people with nice yards and nice houses make for nice neighborhoods. What lies beneath the surface of this anti-messiness, pro-niceness stance is a history of classist, racist, and sexist social structures. So you keep a nice house with a nice pantry, and you're an oppressor. There's
racist.
Just no two ways about it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36. Type in DA, then a quick comment, because we want to hear from you. from you people who are have tidy and organized pantries.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You Please. Nice home you, with nice people and nice yards and nice pantries.
Granite countertops.
You make me sick. You're the problem.
Well, what should we do with them, Dan?
Here's the thing about this silliness. It is all to a point, right? They're crazy like foxes, these new Marxists. And John McWhorter put his finger on it. John McWhorter is the linguistics professor at Columbia University. We've had him on the show several times. Very sharp guy. Center left, but he knows a scam when he sees one. And particularly when it comes to race relations, McWhorter is black, if you're not familiar with him. And he has just torn apart intellectually Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo and their race-hustling tomes that are so popular in corporate boardrooms and K through 12 government school systems these days. McWhorter was on another friend of the show, Glenn Lowry, the great economist from Brown University. He's got a podcast he does, and McWhorter is on it every other week. It's really a good podcast because these are two super intelligent dudes. And McWhorter was on, I guess he was on the Bill Maher show recently. And so he sort of reprised what the conversation they had where he defined the difference between equity and equality. Now, if you've listened to this show, you know, for a long time that we've said they're antonyms. They're presented as synonyms. They're used interchangeably. A lot of people, when they hear equity, they think equality, but they're antonyms. And McWhorter provides a deeper explanation in a more intellectual way than certainly I can. Take a listen.
Well, what I was trying to get across is that the way we use the term equity these days is it's a fig leaf term, because what people mean by it is we want to make sure that people in this organization, in this body, reflect the demographic proportions of this, that, or the other thing. The idea is that there should not be an underrepresentation, for example, of especially black people and Latino people. And to the extent that there is, we're going to force the issue. When you say you're for equity, you don't mean that you're just for equality. What you mean is that draconian measures are going to be taken always, always involving relaxation of standards, although you may think of it as reconceiving them, but it's always relaxation of standards, with the idea being that true equality must be forced. If there isn't this equality, it must be because of racism, for example, and that therefore special methods are necessary to ensure this equality. Those methods are about equity. And the funny thing is that You really learn about why there is ideological conflict. There are people out there who genuinely think that equity is simply a commitment to, you know, equality, that that's all it is, that it's probably this slightly official term for being committed to equality. And they genuinely don't understand, or they genuinely don't see why anybody would have a problem with changing standards, having quotas, and doing all sorts of things in the name of equality and calling it equity. And so I was just saying that, you know, and this is something that I had thought of before I got up on the set. I hadn't thought very hard about it, but I thought equity is like equality, but with something banged out of it. You get rid of the A and the L, and then you've got this word equity. And there's a certain arrogance, or there's a certain know-nothingness in the way you bang out those words and pretend that equity means the same thing. And the reason is that these people think, and this is my hobby horse, these people think that what they're doing is okay because it's battling white power. Anything that battles white power is inherently okay, short maybe of physical violence.
Yeah, maybe, he said, short maybe of physical violence. There's a lot there in that bite, but the two things I would seize upon is just this distinction between the two and the motivation of the either ignorant or purposeful confusion in the language. And the force that's required and the forced relaxation of standards. When you hear all of this, everything is racist type stuff. And somebody actually put together a nice little index of some of the more ridiculous examples of alleged racism, colonialism, all the isms pantry porn was on the list that we just went over. But there are others. PETA says phrases like bring home the bacon are comparable to racism and homophobia.
Oh,
you've got everybody gets to get in there. All of Shakespeare's plays are about race. That's in the Atlantic. Philosophy, systemic racism. Coffee is racist. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are racist. Yes. The Masters tradition, golf.
Yeah, I'm surprised they're not going to change that because they changed master bedroom to primary bedroom.
Is hunting too white? I mean, these are just headlines and, like, you know, myriad periodic particles. The energy system is inherently racist. The racism and resilience behind today's salmon crisis.
There's a salmon crisis?
Salmon, yes. Monkeypox, of course, is racist.
It's called Mpox, yes.
Yeah, the racist roots of fighting obesity. America's national parks face existential crisis over race. I was unaware of that, sure. Is it racist to like big butts? The unbearable whiteness of camping. I mean, these are all headlines from, you know, what you would say, oh, I know that. I've heard of that outlet before. Respect. No. So relaxation of standards. It is always tearing down. Of course, you see that most in a most pronounced fashion in education. From pre-K all the way through postgraduate. Relaxation of standards is the necessary implication, and it will be forced. All in the name of equity. Jefferson in Saugeenash, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. How are you?
Morning.
Well, not a huge comment. Just as a Loyola alum, I'll tell you, it's just real sad when you visit their website. Even when you visit an event or two, the school is all about diversity now. They got a land acknowledgement on their website. When I was there in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, you heard there were three tenets that I thought set us apart from other schools: writing intensive, business ethics, critical thinking. That's all disappeared. And it's really kind of sad, and I hope other alums, like as I do, just separate or divorce themselves from the university. What this professor came out with, I mean, just to think that that's what the parents are paying for, that type of study, that type of just nonsense, it's really sad.
It is. Thanks for the call, Jefferson. Linda, Palos Heights.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I just wanted to say my grandmother used to have a saying, cleanliness is next to godliness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this goes along with the tenets that the Marxists want to push God and religion out of everybody's life. So maybe that's the connection Loyola was trying to make.
Linda, I don't know how to tell you this, but your grandma was racist.
Damn.
Thanks for the call, Linda. Appreciate
it. You could have let her down easy.
Yeah.
But that's in my blood. Cleanliness is next to godliness.
Yeah, everybody's grandma used to say that. Mine did, too.
Well, I say that, and I'm not a grandma.
Close. Soon.
Soon?
I don't know.
What do you know that I don't know?
No, I don't know. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, as far as, like, the organization, like, my house is clean and neat and orderly, and I have a machine shop that I keep the same way, and it has nothing to do with race. It has everything to do with being efficient and attitude. People who work there have a good attitude because they know where everything's at. You're not tripping over stuff. It has nothing to do with race. And are the woke people ever going to wake up and realize how insane they are? Or are they like the people who wear masks nowadays? You know, still, their brains are damaged to a point where they're never coming back.
Well, I don't know, Rick. Efficiency sounds almost like merit. Sounds like a sort of a merit type word, and we know that's racist, too. I don't know. Thanks for the call. That's racist adjacent, I think, efficiency. Mike Littleton, Colorado.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. And, you know, one of the reasons I wish I could be optimistic. I think one of the reasons we don't win this in the end is because we're up against the cult, and it's impervious to logic. And we dismiss these people, like your last call was saying, he keeps his machine shop clean and neat for efficiency's sake. And we look at these people like we look at a woman with a beard, like it's a freak show, and we just dismiss it, right?
Yeah.
But these people are deadly serious while we just dismiss them. And they gain yards, and we might push them back an inch or two here and there, but we're really conceding the field.
And
you had an earlier call.
Completely
I'm sorry,
agree.
Go ahead.
No, I completely agree. Go ahead.
So you had an earlier caller that said, you know, it was kind of a Newt Rockne kind of moment where, hey, we need somebody, you know, to step up and get a sack. One of the reasons I think we concede the field is because we always look out and we think that other person will do it for us. Ted Cruz will give a Senate speech. The Republicans will stand up and defend us. We're past that. It's time that we, you know, in the halls of colleges or whatever, get mad, pull our kids the hell out of these schools and do something. Otherwise, it's all lost. And it's a sad thing, but that's how I feel. So thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Right. Yeah, I mean, those cultists that, you know, you dismissed, like the bearded lady, sort of like you would a bearded lady. Right. The problem is, as Mike in Littleton, Colorado, is they're in charge of a lot.
Right.
Almost everything. And though the things they're not in charge of are afraid of, you know, the people who are in charge of anything they're not in charge of are afraid of them, which sort of gives them de facto charge. Yeah. And right. Expecting politicians to deliver you from this. I mean, with few exceptions, politicians are back of the parade types, not front of the parade. So better come up with a better answer. Ryan in New Lenox.
Yeah, Dan, I'm really concerned for you with this whole pantry thing because mm-hmm. I know the only thing you make for dinner is reservations, and the only thing in your pantry is like a bottle of Jim Beam or something. So couldn't it be said that you're the most racist person ever, according to the
Because my pantry is empty sans booze, yeah.
Well, it's when
empty,
we were there
it's
with
free
the...
of dust, it's free of crumbs, it's free and clear of everything. You don't even know what a spice drawer is.
No, I don't. I thought that was a band. Thanks for the call.
I got to tell you what, me and the family stopped by your place in Naples before it was decimated by a hurricane. Guess what was in his pantry? It was...
Not much.
Nothing. You could sleep an extra person in there.
Yeah.
There was a bag of coffee, mm-hmm. some coffee filters.
The coffee's racist, so that's a problem.
And I think you had tea, but that was pretty.
Sure. Well,
and
for
some
my
salt and pepper packets.
For my afternoon tea. Of course. Yeah, salt and pepper. A little seasoning.
Such a bachelor. And that oven's never been used. No.
No.
The stove, maybe.
No, I use the oven like as like an extra bookcase. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. You know, a caller or two ago talked about, you know, why they win and so forth. And I think, you know, part of this has to be is that, you know, we actually like ourselves and we like our lives and they hate themselves and they want us to hate ourselves as much as they hate themselves. That's, I think, part of it. And, I wanted to bring up, too, a good book that talks about what your last segment was with Fauci and the government, and then this one here about the words. A great book is called The Black Book of Communism. It's by various authors. It's about 800 pages. Chapter 1, or Part 1, is called A War Against a State Against Its People, Violence, Terror, and Tyranny and Repression in the Soviet Union. That's what we have here, that's what we've had here in this country. For the last 3 years, a war against its own people. And part two is a war on words, and talked about how they did this same type of thing in the Soviet Union. So these two segments dovetail perfectly with that book, Black Book of Communism. Excellent book, very depressing, but gives you a lot of knowledge on the way these people think and the way that they are.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the Daily Mail reporting yesterday that Trump is expected to be indicted today, although that's unclear if the grand jury in Manhattan will be done with their business, but that's the expectation, and that plans will be then arranged between the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the Secret Service for Trump's surrender and appearance in New York City next week. He will not be arraigned this week, according to a source familiar with the proceedings that spoke with the Daily Mail. Yeah.
What's going on?
It's about to get interesting.
Sources are leaked everywhere. Even the Supreme, nothing's sacred anymore. Even the Supreme Court decisions are leaked.
This is
our new world, right?
A lot of questions surrounding this, clearly, including whether or not even Alvin Bragg can get out of the starting gate and survive a challenge on the basis of the statute of limitations having run. So let's get into it with our friend Andy McCarthy. He is a former federal prosecutor, interestingly, in the Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office, U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District. Also a contributing editor to National Review and, of course, the author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. How are you?
Good. So I know you wrote about it, but you're the prosecutor, so you explain it. There may be an argument to be made that the statute has run. We may not have enough information to know that, but for those who are just looking at the sort of a 2 years for misdemeanor, 5 years for a felony, and the statute is run because the payment was made 6 years ago, it's not that easy.
Yeah, and I can certainly understand that because there's a lot of moving pieces here. But, you know, basically you have a situation where Alvin Bragg, the elected progressive Democrat who is the district attorney in Manhattan, is trying to take something that is a misdemeanor that would never be prosecuted against anyone not named Donald Trump in New York, and not only bring a case based on it, but inflate it into a felony. And the consequences of that are multiple in the sense that it affects the amount of time he might be facing if he were convicted. It would be 4 years for the felony. It would be just a few months if it was the misdemeanor. But also the statute of limitations, Dan, as you mentioned, is different. It's 2 years for a misdemeanor and five for a felony. It's impossible to explain this without laying out a little bit of what the important facts are. Basically, the crime here that Bragg will allege is the falsification of business records. That's the misdemeanor. His theory for why that happened is simply that when Trump reimbursed Michael Cohen, who was then his lawyer slash fixer, for laying out $130,000 for the non-disclosure agreement with Stormy Daniels. In fact, that was the payment or reimbursement of a debt that Trump incurred, a debt to Cohen in 2016. And the way they decided to reimburse that was to pay him monthly through 2017. When they booked in Trump's records what the payment to Cohen, instead of showing it as reimbursement of a debt, they showed it as payment of legal fees, which, you know, it doesn't sound like it's a big deal, but like for the government, it's a big deal in the sense that, you know, for example, reimbursement of a debt is a non-taxable event. Payment of legal fees is a taxable event. So it could have had different ramifications, but that's, in a nutshell, that's what he's saying the crime is. Now, the timeline here would be the payments to Cohn go from the beginning of 2017 to the last one. These were monthly payments, which happened on December 5th of 2017. And I presume what Bragg is going to argue is that gets him at least into 2018, because in 2018, that's when the tax consequences of 2017 are accounted for. So in other words, the 2017 records generate other records that you need to generate in order to close out the 2017 year. And if I'm right about that, let's say that the last thing of consequence that happened here was around tax time in 2018. That would have been 5 years, you know, from April or so of 2018 would have been April. 5 years would be April of 2023. which might explain why you're seeing all this frenetic activity now, mm-hmm. And why there's a sudden rush to indict this case. I think he's going to have a hard time, obviously, with the statute of limitations. But I think the more important thing, and I'm sorry to go on and on about this, but it's the only way to explain it.
No, it's the more difficult thing. Helps. Yeah,
the more difficult thing for him is the statute of limitations is problematic enough, but even more problematic is the idea that this was a felony, because in order to inflate that misdemeanor into a felony under New York law, what he's got to show is that Trump, in falsifying the business records, intentionally attempted to conceal another crime that he knew he was committing. And I think it's going to be hard enough for Bragg to show that Trump even falsified the records, because I don't think that was his job at, you know, accounting at the right. at the Trump organization. He may not have even known how they were booking this. He may have known, you know, he signed some of the checks, but he may not have known. But the problem with the felony is even people like me who've been lawyers for more years than I care to admit to are having a hard time trying to understand what other crime Bragg is talking about here. Like, what other crime lurks here? Been a lot of talk about campaign finance violations. I don't think it is a campaign finance violation. And even if it were, when New York law talks about another concealing another crime, it has to be another New York crime. It can't be a federal crime. And the campaign finance violations in connection with presidential elections are federal, not state. But even if I'm wrong about that, and Bragg has some crime that he can show was somehow lurking underneath the falsification of these records, the problem he has is that he's got to show beyond a reasonable doubt that Trump not only knew this, but consciously acted in a way to conceal that other crime. And I think the best interpretation of what happened here is if he's responsible for falsifying the records, he did it for the same reason he entered into the non-disclosure arrangement in the first place, which was to keep it from Melania, that he was entering a hush money arrangement with a porn star, and to keep it from voters before the 2016 election. Now, those two things, you may think they're disreputable. I think they're disreputable, but they're not crimes. And what Bragg needs is a crime. So I just don't see this case.
Now, one point that I'm pointing out that CNN Van Jones talked about, he said, why rush to this? Why should we start with Georgia, where he was interfering with elections? Why is Bragg doing this? So even the left is saying, why is he doing this? Is it all political to elevate Bragg's name maybe to the national spotlight so he can run for higher office?
Yeah, Amy, I think there's two things on that. First is the thing that we discussed earlier in our conversation, which is that the clock may be ticking on Bragg. In other words, if he doesn't bring it now, he may lose it.
Okay.
You know, he may be on the outer ring of even his version of what the statute of limitations says. But I think the other point is one that we miss often because our media coverage is so Washington-centric. We're so focused on the federal government. In the federal system, prosecutors, you know, U.S. attorneys, the attorney general, they're appointed by the president and they're vetted by the Senate. And at least the vetting process is supposed to make sure that they're not going to use their law enforcement power as a political weapon. And if they do, they could be removed, right? In the state system, it's very different. In the states, politics pervades law enforcement because these district attorney positions and state attorneys general are elected politics positions. So, for example, Bragg ran, just like Letitia James in New York, the state attorney general, they ran on the idea that if they got into power, they were going to use their authority against Trump. They used that as a political issue. So I think, you know, we're much better, and we'll probably analyze this all a lot better, if we look at Bragg not as a law enforcement official, but as an elected progressive Democrat who was doing in office what he said he was going to do when he got elected.
Another matter there's news on that relates to the investigations and perhaps forthcoming prosecutions of the former president. And that's with respect to the special counsel on the handling of classified materials. Right. The ABC was reporting yesterday that a retired U.S. District Court judge, wrote last week, prosecutors in Special Counsel Jack Smith's office had made a prima facie showing that the former president had committed criminal violations, according to their sources, that he deliberately misled his own attorneys, did Trump, about his retention of classified materials. Well, one, I mean, just your underlying assessment of the importance of that that leak. And then two, on here we go again, Mueller 2.0, with things leaking out of the special counsel's office.
Yeah, I think this goes, Dan, to what I said about the Mar-a-Lago documents case once it became – once we got the revelations that, Biden also was a serial hoarder of classified documents.
Mm-hmm.
The special counsel may have a lot of evidence that Trump retained classified documents illegally at Mar-a-Lago, but the Biden revelations, especially after the Justice Department let Hillary Clinton off the hook for an egregious violation, they made it politically very difficult to bring a documents case against Trump. So what I argued when the Biden stuff came out was that what you were going to hear now from Democrats and the Biden administration and the Biden special counsel was the Mar-a-Lago investigation is no longer really a document retention case. They're going to say it's a grand jury obstruction case because that's what distinguishes the Trump situation from the Biden situation. And if they just tried to indict him straight up on retaining classified documents, then Biden would have a problem, right? So they completely changed their emphasis here to grand jury obstruction. Why is that important? Because the lawyers who were working for Trump, including this guy, Evan Corcoran, who was the subject of the order that you're talking about, he represented when the Justice Department issued Trump a grand jury subpoena requiring him to turn over any documents marked classified that were in his possession. Corcoran basically took the lead in producing that. And had conversations with Trump about what was produced. And then in June of 2022, they produced 38 documents, which they said was all of it. They said they had done a thorough search at Mar-a-Lago, and this is what they had. And, of course, we know that, like, about 6 weeks later, when the search was done, they found over 100 more. So the theory here is that Trump misled his lawyers into misrepresenting to the grand jury that all of the documents had been turned over in June when he was still hoarding them.
Right. And so,
how
do you distinguish that from Biden? Because I mean, Biden, because he just said, come on in. And even though they were producing documents, they were producing documents. Well, come on in and look yourself. And then they found more documents. Ostensibly, when they produced documents, said, well, this is what we have. And this is all we have. And then they found more. And then, well, we have more. And then they said, well, if you want to come in, come on in. I mean, how those are sort of a distinction without a difference. We're representing that this is an exhaustive search and these are the documents we have that you should have. But then we find more and then you find more. And so, I mean, in the Trump case, possibly he was directing his attorney or misinforming his attorney. And it's also possible he was like, yeah, I don't know, whatever. Go through the boxes, whatever's classified, whatever they want, give them. Don't give them this, give them that, whatever. Like he's, we have no idea what the conversations were. And it seems to me that this leak is, to your point, about setting up the media to make the distinction you were just making to try to sell the public on prosecuting Trump for something very similar to what we understand Joe Biden did.
Yeah, well, I think that's what the messaging has been about ever since we learned about Biden. But to go, you mentioned the judge who issued this order. Now, we haven't seen the order, right? This is the subject of leaks to ABC.
Right.
But the judge in question, she's not actually retired. She's stepping down from being the chief judge of the district court in Washington, and that's just because they rotate position.
Right. Okay.
But her name is Beryl Howell. More important is like who she is, right? Yeah. She was Pat Leahy's you know, warrior on the Senate Judiciary Committee. So she was appointed to the bench by Obama. She's not exactly Trump friendly, as you might imagine. And this was her parting shot. The reason the District of Columbia has some interesting local rules, and one of them is that the chief judge handles all grand jury matters that come up for litigation. So that if something comes up where, you know, the grand jury is trying to get something, somebody doesn't want to turn it over to them, that goes in front of the chief judge in cases in the District of Columbia, which, by the way, could very well be why special counsel like Bob Mueller set up shop in Washington while, you know, Chief Judge Howell was there to make all the rulings. So she's now stepping down and a different judge will be taking that role. This is her last, probably her last ruling in the grand jury connection. And what she said was that Trump was, according to what we've seen, we haven't seen the actual ruling, but what's reported is that she said that Trump was involved in a scheme of obstruction to retain documents that goes back before there was a grand jury investigation, when he was apparently misleading the National Archives for a year about what he had retained and whether he would give it back and all that stuff. So what she's saying is that there was a pattern of conduct for 18 months or close to 18 months by the time Evan Corcoran and another Trump lawyer named Christina Bob represented to the FBI that they had conducted a thorough search and that these 38 documents were the only ones left.
But we don't know. And on what basis does she make that conclusion?
She's looking at all of the correspondence between the lawyers that Trump designated to deal with the National Archives and the lawyers for the National Archives who beginning in, I think, January or February of 2021, tried to get back reams of documents that they understood that
but communication between Trump and his attorneys is privileged.
Well, this is what the upshot of the ruling is, that the privilege, the attorney-client privilege, is pierced. That is, the communications are not confidential if they are in connection or they're under what's known as the crime fraud exception.
Yeah. Right,
to the attorney. So if the communications are in furtherance of a criminal scheme, and here what they're saying is it's a criminal scheme to obstruct the grand jury, then they lose their confidentiality and the prosecutors can get them.
Well, but I understand the crime fraud exception, but how do they bootstrap to conclude that the exception is applicable?
Well, I guess what they're saying is that there was a grand jury subpoena that demanded that they turn over all of the documents, and they said that in lieu of a grand jury appearance, they would take a sworn statement saying that all of the documents they had done a thorough search and all of the documents had been turned over. So in June, they give them a sworn statement, which is supposed to be communicated to the grand jury, that says we've done a thorough search of Mar-a-Lago and these are the only remaining classified documents. So what they're saying is that was a lie to the grand jury that was the circumstance.
But how do you
I don't know.
You know, I mean, I'm,
you know, I mean, it's
we can go back and forth. How do you establish it? Was it just a good faith mistake? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that seems
that's what a case is about.
Yeah.
Let's be clear. He hasn't been charged yet.
Right.
So what happens in an investigation is you have evidence that the law was violated, but you don't necessarily know that you can prove it until you figure out, can I prove all of the acts that are necessary to establish a crime? And as you're saying, can I establish that the person I want to charge had the intent that's necessary to commit it? So far, they haven't charged him, but, you know, you build a case a brick at a time. So that's what they're trying to do.
He is Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney at the Southern District of New York, contributing editor at National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate your insights and expertise.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The American Bankers Association had a little confab, and before they adjourned for dinner and strippers, they heard from the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, to give the regime's talking point on the banking system.
The steps we took were not focused on aiding specific banks or classes of banks. Our intervention was necessary to protect the broader U.S. banking system. And similar actions could be warranted if smaller institutions suffered deposit runs that posed the risk of contagion. I believe that our actions reduced the risk of further bank failures that would have imposed losses on the deposit insurance fund, which is paid for through fees on banks. Second, we announced a new facility to provide additional liquidity to the banking system. The Fed's new lending facility, the Bank Term Funding Program, is designed to help banks meet the needs of all of their depositors. The situation is stabilizing, and the U.S. banking system remains sound.
U.S. banking system sound, there's a headline, says Yellen. Also embedded there, if you caught it in that scintillating speech she was giving, that smaller banks will get backstopped by the federal government maybe as well. Oh, good. Moral hazards all around. Hey. For more on this, Steve Moore, economist and author of Govzilla, joins us. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning, guys. And by the way, when Janet Yellen says that the banking system is sound, it just reminds me a little bit about, you know, those riots in the streets of Chicago were mostly peaceful.
They were. I mean, what are you talking about?
And that inflation is transitory.
Transitory. What's that?
They let them pull up with U-Hauls and let them take whatever they wanted. It was great. Free stuff for everybody. And our city has never been the same.
So what is the state of the banking system in your estimation, Steve?
That's a great question. I think that in my estimation, I don't think there's going to be an all-out, you know, bank failure. I think that you had some banks that made some really bad decisions. And isn't it interesting that one of them is Silicon Valley Bank, which was one of the most woke banks in America. You know, it spent $5 billion on climate change policies. I don't think those investments turned out so well. So overall, I would say that it looks like the worst may be behind us. I do think there may be some more bank failures, but the big four banks, you know, which includes, you know, Citibank and J.P. Morgan and you know, Wells Fargo. Those banks have hundreds of billions of dollars of assets, and they're in good shape. What worries me the most about this is two things. One is the moral hazard problem, that every time a company or a bank, a big company or big bank, makes a bad business decision, there's Uncle Sam swooping in and giving them a big safety net, which is really just unfair. I mean, it's bad. It's not capitalism. It's not the free enterprise system to bail out every company every time they make a bad decision.
Well, you just heard Yellen expanding the circle. It will be fair because everybody's going to get backstopped by the
everybody
government. She didn't go quite that far, but.
Right. And so this is so frustrating because this is called the too big to fail doctrine. And what's happened in America is, you know, every business that has ties with Washington, I guess it's you're too big to fail if you give big donations to politicians. But Dan, you and me and Amy, we're not too big to fail. And that's why I got to tell you, people are angry about what is going on in Washington and the idea that, you know, every time somebody is politically well connected, they're going to get money from the government. But the little guy gets crushed by this. I want to go back to one point I made last week, but I have to repeat it. If people are wondering why this is happening, why the banks are under so much financial stress right now, it circles right back to the $6 trillion spending bill spree that was launched by Joe Biden when he came to office with this funny money, dumping you know, $100 bills out of helicopter windows, unleashing inflation, unleashing higher interest rates, and putting banks into, you know, a situation of financial stress because they're holding on to these bonds, that these government bonds that have been, their value has been reduced by, you know, 20 or 30%. So we have to get, if they were serious in Washington, if the Biden administration and Janet Yellen were serious about repairing this situation, the first thing they would do is take a chainsaw out of the federal budget. But they're not doing that.
Well, I'm just happy that Silicon Valley depositors like Gavin Newsom and BuzzFeed and Fox Media right. and Black Lives Matter, I'm just glad they're going to be made whole. That's what's important.
And SD.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, and I'm glad that you and I are going to pay, you know, for that. And,
yeah.
You know, when they say,
higher
oh, don't worry,
fees.
The
yeah.
taxpayers aren't going to pay for this. Of course they are. We're the ones who are going to pay these fees and all of these other things. So, you know, it's just a frustrating situation. We've got to get back to the idea. You know, in fact, I just got a call this morning with some of the, you know, members of Congress just saying, you know, they asked, what do I do? What do we do here? And I said, you know, why don't we just get back to the free enterprise system, you know, where we're not bailout nation. And well, and that would be go a long way, by the way, to discipline companies from making these outrageous wrong decisions they've made in terms of their finances.
Well, what about the regulators, the bank regulators who were supposed to watch yeah. after SVB and who are obviously asleep at the wheel? Are they, is any
completely.
Repercussions for them? I mean, they completely did not do their job.
There should be. In a rational world, there should be. But this woman who runs the San Francisco Regional Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco, I forget her name. I think it's Mary Ball or something like
Mary
that.
Mary Daly.
They're talking about putting her on, you know, she could be next in line to be the Federal Reserve chairman.
Well, I know. That's yeah, because she's.
Oh my,
she's
so she's getting rewarded. Okay.
Well, she's fighting climate change. She's
oh, that's
somebody.
Right.
So
it's
that's
all about
what's happened.
Change.
I mean, yeah. this is an important point. So what's happened is everything, these regulators, isn't it interesting, by the way, that we have this whole pyramid of regulations, but the regulators are always one step behind. You know, they're always one step behind. And so now you've got the situation where they've just become ideological. You know, Biden is hiring people for these positions based not on their knowledge of banking and finance, but whether they believe in climate change and whether they care, you know, whether they want to carry the LGBTQ agenda. That's the qualification now.
Well, right. And I think we have it reversed, though, don't we? I mean, this is classic agency capture. All this talk about we've nationalized the banks. The government owns the banks. Does the government own the banks or do the banks own the government? Because I think that distinction is
good
important.
Question. Yeah. Well, I will use the word incestuous because that's what we have right now in America today, folks. This incestuous relationship between big business, big banks, and big government. And my worry, you know, about this is that eventually you're going to see the sharks continue to swallow up the minnows. And look, I go back. Do you guys remember the, you know, classic movie It's a Wonderful Life with,
oh, yeah.
you know, Jimmy Stewart and his building and loan, you know, this local bank, these community banks are being swallowed up now by the big banks and the regulators. That's the other thing. Regulations tend to favor the big guys, not the little guys, because the big massive banks like J.P. Morgan, they can underwrite the cost of these regulations. The little guys can't.
We don't live in your magical Frank Capra world, Steve. We live in the real world, and we can't allow banks to fail. Right? I mean,
yeah,
that's the end. Hey, just one more. We can't. If Silicon Valley fails, and we let it bought but if we don't backstop, then it will create a contagion run. Why can't a bank fail, even if it's a good sized bank, First Republic or SVB or Signature Bank of New York? And hey, if UBS or Morgan Stanley or Goldman wants to come in and buy them, then you go ahead and buy them. But you work it out in the sector, whatever.
That's so, you know, first of all, what are you? You're a cheerleader for Potter, right? You want Potter to take over.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Hey, you know, you can't pay your bills and here comes Potter. That's how it works.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the free market. It's not capitalism. People in Main Street USA feel like they're getting screwed and they are here. And, you know, and it all circles back to a massive out of control government. We have been practicing for the last 3 years now, modern monetary theory, mm-hmm. that the government can just tax. I mean, borrow and borrow and borrow and spend whatever it wants to. And there's no negative repercussions for that because we're the world reserve currency. And it's crashing. It's crashing right before our very eyes. How obvious was this that these dingbat theories weren't going to work? So if I sound a little frustrated, I am.
No, don't worry. We're going to stick the landing, whatever the hell that means. Speaking of which, what is the Fed? What's the Fed going to do today? Is it going to be a quarter point? Going to be half a point? It's going to be no points? What's it going to do?
You know, it's a it would be a tough decision if I were. You know, I was nominated to be on the Fed. If I were there, I would be. You know, I could see the arguments both. I think they will do a quarter point today, but here's the problem. If they raise rates, which they probably will, and remember, here's the other thing. The rates were 0.5% just 2 years ago. Now they're 4.75% headed to 5%. That's the reason. That's one of the reasons these banks are in so much trouble is they're holding government bonds that have fallen in value by 25 or 30%. So their balance sheet has been wrecked by these higher interest rates. But on the other hand, we still have 6 to 6.5% inflation. So what do you do with the Fed?
Well,
I mean, you know what they should be doing, Dan and Amy? You know what they should be doing? They should be taking a chainsaw out of the budget and cutting all this excessive government spending. That would be much more effective than the Fed continuing to raise interest rates.
Lisa Abramowitz, who's with Bloomberg, she pointed this out on Twitter the other day. This is interesting, too, a little look ahead. She wrote, the question for the Fed isn't whether to hike 25 or 50 basis points this week. It's when do they start cutting rates? At least according to the Fed funds futures, they've priced out rate cuts and priced in rate cuts as soon as June. Rate cuts as soon as June?
Really?
That's
what's priced into the market right now is that the Fed, and you know, all the betting is that, you know, that sometime this summer, the Fed's going to start cutting rates again. And, you know, that's not going to solve the inflation problem.
So
financial problems in this country.
So then the message is going to be to Mom, Pa, America is it's more important to prop up the stock market than it is to stop your food prices from increasing 10% year over year.
Boy, what are you? You're soak the rich guy. I mean, that's the other irony of this whole episode is that, you know, 1 week Biden's out there saying, we're going to sock it to the rich. We're going to sock them right in the nose. We're going to hit them with the highest taxes ever and blah, blah, blah. You know, they have too much money. And then what are we doing with these bailouts? Who are we bailing out? Not me, not you, not Amy.
All right.
They're bailing out the rich people and the big corporations. It's so absurd. So we have to collect more taxes. You know, the Babylon Bee had a great piece on this. You know, we have to sack the rich so we can get more money out of them so we can give the money back to the rich.
Exactly. All right, Stephen Moore, before we let you go, have you talked to your friend, former President Donald Trump lately, and how is he holding up?
I saw Trump at Mar-a-Lago about 2 or 3 weeks ago. He's tanned, rested, and ready. He's running. You know, the latest development on this, I'd like your guys' reaction to this. Did you see that DeSantis is really taking some swings at Trump now? Did you see that?
Well, yeah, but I mean, how's
pretty modest, right, but yeah.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, it's interesting. He's taking the gloves off a little bit. It was pretty. My advice to DeSantis is don't get in the sewer with the sewer rat, you know? And I think DeSantis is much better off kind of ignoring Trump rather than, you know, hitting him back.
Well, a reporter asked him the question. I mean, you know, he said, I don't know about paying hush money off to a former porn star. Because most Americans, we don't know what that's like. Yeah. We're not part of that process.
Yeah,
but I mean, this obviously, Rand Paul, you know, tweeted that the New York DA should be put in jail for what he's doing. Obviously, this is overtly political, what's going on here. But when last time you saw Trump, did he know this was coming?
We didn't talk about that, but I will say this, that, you know, this must be the only explanation for this if the arrest happens. What do you place the odds at? What do you think? Is he going to get arrested, Dan?
Yes.
You think so, Amy?
Yes, because I agree with everything Dan
says. I doubt it. I mean, look.
You doubt it?
Really? You do doubt it?
Alvin Bragg is – Alvin Bragg's too far gone.
You know why? Because if he gets arrested, it is going to be one of the great outrages of all time. Well, let's not forget, folks, no matter what you think about Donald Trump, these are the same people for 2 years who pursued the Russia collusion hoax. These are the same people who tried to impeach him. These are the same people who outrageously raided his Mar-a-Lago home. These are the people over and over and over again. There's been no president in the history of the United States who's been more mistreated and more unfairly treated than Donald Trump. And I don't know anything about the Stormy Daniels stuff. I'm just saying, if they want to guarantee that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, they will arrest him, because that is going to make him a victim. And he loves to play the part of the victim. So maybe this is a grand plan by the Democrats to ensure that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee.
I think you're getting to it. Steve Moore, economist and author of GovZilla. Steve, thanks as always.
All right. And he joined us. He says thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We haven't spoken with her in a bit, but the occasion of a new book presents a good opportunity to do so. Amber Athey is a Washington editor for The Spectator and host of the Unfit to Print podcast. Her new book, The Snowflakes Revolt, How Woke Millennials Hijacked American Media. Amber, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
So hijacked, that implies that they took it over from...
Forcibly.
Well, they took it over from a group other than older fellow travelers.
That's right, and that's exactly what's happened to the media. This is a case where the woke millennials have basically used campus mob politics to wrest control from editors and other newsroom leaders, whether it's through attempts at public shaming of the publication and its editorial staff on social media channels. Sometimes it's internal revolts where they will sign on to admonishing letters or try to organize unions to oppose some of the editorial direction of the news outlets. And they often will partner with outside advocacy groups, as we saw recently at the New York Times, where a number of staffers signed on to a public letter alongside GLAAD, which is an LGBTQ activist organization. So they are basically trying to create a culture of fear wherein anyone who doesn't go along with instituting radical progressive ideology into journalism has to be excised from the entire institution.
Yeah, but how is that different? I mean, it seems to me this is just cannibalization of Jacobins at the hands of Jacobins. I mean, the neo-Jacobins. But I mean, the previous iterations, the Gen Xers and the baby boomers. It's not like those newsrooms were dominated by center-right peaceful pluralists.
You're right. This is fundamentally different, though, because, yes, newsrooms were liberal. Yes, they were obviously biased against conservatives. But what's happening now is just a fundamental rejection of what were traditionally understood to be journalistic ethics. The activism that's taking place at media outlets now is about getting rid of things like striving for the truth. They don't want to have debates. I mean, even CNN, right, would have people affiliated with the Trump campaign on as contributors. They don't even want to give voices to those people anymore, these young progressives, because they truly believe that they have reached some higher plane and that they have a monopoly on truth. So anyone else's differing ideas that could challenge that truth are not allowed to be published in their papers or given airtime to. For example, in my book, I write about at Politico, where one author by the name of Gabby Orr wrote an article about the fact that the GOP was trying to advance legislation to protect women's sports from biological men. And the young people who went after her for that article said that she had not exercised her journalistic duty because she had quoted several conservatives who used the phrase biological men, which rejects the true identity of transgender women.
I do have to say, too, I noted this the other day. It just tickles me. The New York Times Guild, and they did a little one-day strike because labor negotiations are dragging on. But poor Sulzberger. But the statement from the union, the wage proposal for management fails to meet the economic moment, lagging far behind both inflation and the average rate of wage gains. Oh, my gosh. The New York Times Guild just found out that inflation isn't transitory, despite their reporting.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And the New York Times is really ground zero for a lot of what I talk about in the book, because their reaction to the Tom Cotton op-ed, where he called for sending in the National Guard to quell the riots in 2020, led to the resignation / firing of multiple editors there, simply because, again, they had given a platform to a Republican senator. And that was unacceptable to these woke staffers. They actually accused their colleagues of creating an unsafe work environment for Black people by publishing a differing opinion. The warped way that these people view media platforms and journalistic virtue is just insanity.
And you lived this. I mean, you witnessed it firsthand because you were a vocal conservative at Georgetown University, and you ended up in the White House press corps as a correspondent. So how did that all happen, and what did you learn while you were with the other your peers in the White House, so to speak?
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you brought up my experience in college. I went to Georgetown University, which is very liberal, and I was chair of the College Republicans while I was there, and I was reported to the administration several different times. Once for trying to start a gun safety organization, one for bringing Dr. Christina Hoff Sommers to speak on campus.
Oh, no.
And I'm sure there were a few other incidents as well that I'm not remembering at the moment, but it was exactly the same tactics that these people are using against newsroom leaders.
Go ahead.
Well, and then on the question of the White House briefing room, I think what that really taught me about the media landscape is that these people are fundamentally not very bright. They're not especially talented. Most of them are quite mediocre, and they usually come from backgrounds of great privilege, and yet they're the ones lecturing everyone else about how they have privilege because of their skin color or because of their gender. And so it was a great exercise in learning not to take any of these people seriously.
Yeah, it's so accurate.
Yeah, I
think I'm a bit older than you, but I'm just hearkening back to college. I did the same thing, ran a conservative student group, brought people to campus and so forth. I got whistled before the state senate or the state senate, the student senate,
okay,
student
you,
senate.
Big difference
at Northwestern. So this is in the early 90s. The students, so you know, going on for a long time at Northwestern and Medill and so on, and journalism, you know, there's all of the histrionics and they like try to remove me as the head of this volunteer conservative students group and so on and so forth for the speakers that I brought and some of the flyers that I posted advertising the speakers and so forth. But so, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. The people that are now at that mid-level or a step or two above mid-level were the people that I went to college with 25 years ago, almost 30 years ago now, and that's who dominated. And then those coming in behind them that are, you know, generation down, millennials, as you're talking about. I mean, it's just the increasing radicalization all the way from the 60s to the present.
Exactly. The millennials have basically taken what was the left-wing campus culture in the 60s and 70s and turned it into Bolshevikism. It's very radical. These are people who just really reject basic founding principles in America. They think that America is a terrible place to live. They believe that everything that happens in their life is out of their control. The system is constantly working against them. And a lot of them suffer from mental illness, because when you have this worldview, it leads you to feel very powerless. And so I think a lot of their politics is about trying to take back power and control, because they don't understand how to do that in their personal life.
Well, and also, I mean, we talked about New York Times staffers getting mugged by reality, the reality of inflation. Over at CNN, literally getting mugged by reality. Kyung La, Kyung La is a correspondent. She tweeted out, got robbed again. Her photog and I were at City Hall in San Francisco to do an interview. We had
on crime.
We had security to watch our rental car plus crew car. Thieves did this in under 4 seconds. Security stopped the jerks, whoa, ho, 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 from stealing other bags. But seriously, this is ridiculous. She just realized, she just found out that crime and lawlessness in big cities like San Francisco is a bit ridiculous. Welcome to the party, CNN.
Uh-huh. This is what they vote for. This is what they advocate for in their columns or on TV or in their news articles. They're constantly quoting so-called experts who are really just left-wing activists who are calling for defund the police, and then they get surprised when something bad happens to them. And shockingly, if you look at some of the replies to her from people who are in the media and are working as active journalists, saying, well, this is just part of living in a city, and if you don't understand then we can't help you. I mean, they were truly victim-blaming her as if she was supposed to be okay with being robbed because that's just what we expect from city.
I know. That's big city living.
I know. And Amber, there was one person who was interviewed by ABC here in Chicago, and they literally said, every night I just go in my basement and pretend this isn't happening. And I will never forget that. You know, like they're that, you know, they know you live in the city, it's expected, but I'm just going to pretend it's not happening and go in my basement.
Well, that one and my personal favorite is the guy who's walking down the street with his wife.
Oh, that's
he gets
right.
winged in the hand with a bullet.
That's right.
And he says to the local media, yeah, you know, that's just the kind of stuff that happens in big cities. Right. If you don't want to get shot, then don't live in a big city. If you don't want to get carjacked, don't live in a big city. That's all.
You don't want high taxes.
Or at least vote for the people who are going to try to tackle the crime issue. There was a similar situation. I think it was back in 2017 or 2018. It was pretty early in my media career where there was this guy who worked for a really left-wing outlet. It might have been Vice or something to that effect. And he was mugged in D.C. And his response, the column that he wrote, this is how like into his own politics and ideology he was stuck in it. He wrote a column about how it was basically his fault for being white and how he wasn't mad at the person who stole from him.
Right.
What is wrong? That's like a psychosis at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those outlets that kept their accounts at Silicon Valley Bank to make sure they're protected by all of us. Amber Athey, Washington editor for The Spectator and host of the Unfit to Print podcast, the new book, which sounds like a very fun read, The Snowflakes Revolt, How Woke Millennials Hijacked American Media. Amber, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure having you on. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. And only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. April 4th, school board elections, municipal elections, of course, but school board particular focus. And we talked to Ted Dabrowski at Wirepoints yesterday about this report they did on the 20 biggest school districts not named Chicago in the state of Illinois and what the reading and math proficiencies were, among other things, what that tells us, in addition to the underlying financing, how are, as you see your property taxes increase substantially, are you seeing academic performance similarly increase? And the answer generally is no. I think we got a lot of feedback. There's people shocked to learn, for example, Wheaton-Warrenville South High School District, fewer than half of the students in Wheaton-Warrenville South are proficient, grade level proficient in reading and math. And got this email, the issue, wanting more on this, the guy who emailed us writes, the issue nobody talks about is metrics. What is considered proficient? What is the percentage correct required to achieve proficiency? Is it the same in every school district, county, state? Is there some universal metric that can truly be compared between states? Without a yardstick to base performance, how can anyone talk convincingly on the subject? Instead, there are two teams with the people in the middle defaulting to it can't be that bad. Well, a little bit more color on that. Well, first of all, with respect to Illinois, and parents with kids in these age groups probably know, for third to eighth graders, the test is the Illinois Assessment of Readiness. for 11th grade, it's SAT. So that's the basis, and this is all pulled from Illinois State Board of Elections. That's where WirePoints gets its data, from the Illinois State Board of, Illinois State Board of Education. That is not elections, Illinois State Board of Education. So 3rd through 8th grade, Illinois Assessment of Readiness Test. For the 11th grade, it's SAT. So those are some good indicators. And, I mean, in terms of, you know, do you want to compare the tests? There's different tests that are used by different states, but there also is the National Association of Educational Progress Tests. And, but again, not used in every state, but you have cohorts of students in every state. And so you can do a little bit of apples-to-apples comparison. And by the way, the NAEP scores for Illinois 4th grade reading, 33% statewide, is pretty much in line with Illinois' testing overall of about 30%. So some different tests, and so some different scoring, probably some different questions, but the same buckets of things, reading comprehension, multiple choice questions, so on. So we can, at a later point in time, you know, get copies of the tests, and we can, old tests, and we can go through them if you really want to. But it's the testing that parents should probably have an idea about, if, as your kids have gone through school or are in school. And by the way, one of the other things that would be interesting to get feedback on is just what you observe as parents. I mean, you have to have some idea, based on your own education, how rigorous you think the education your child is, right?
Right.
You see the homework they bring, or if they don't bring it.
Or lack of homework.
they probably at some point asked for help with homework, whether it's reading or math or science or some other subject. So you have to have some idea whether this is preparatory, right? So going back to the WirePoints report, I mean, just to give you some other school districts, you're going to be shocked.
What?
I'm telling you. People are going to be shocked.
You have District 214. It's perfect. You don't even have to discuss it.
District 214?
That's my town.
Yeah, Township High School District 214. Yeah, we got it.
Uh-oh. Don't laugh.
It's perfect, is it? Slightly less than perfect. I mean, again, if it was 48 and 47 in Wheaton, you think these other school districts are going to get 90%? No, they're not.
No.
These suburban school districts are, well, I don't know how to say it, else to say it. They're perpetrating a fraud. Beautiful buildings, and oh, it's so great.
All the
and
fancy
I went there.
Sports
and,
stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And they have all the accoutrements you could ever dream of. Some high schools look like college campuses.
214?
Yeah. What do we got?
42% at grade level in reading.
Oof.
42% at grade level in math. Reading at grade level by race, 56% proficient for whites, 58% for Asian, 18% Hispanic, 17% black. Graduation rate, 94%. Grade level reading, 42%. 94%, 42%.
Oh,
teacher ratings.
Oh, boy.
99.8% of teachers at 214 are rated excellent or proficient.
And who did the rating? The teachers did. I give myself
the teachers are great.
Minus.
Everybody graduates and nobody can read or do math.
Yay!
Well, nobody, but half the kids,
right,
can't
the
read
kids
or do math. Six in 10 here.
Boy.
I mean, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much money. Barrington, we profiled Barrington 220 the other day with the school board's focus on making sure smut is widely available in the library and in the classroom. How's Barrington 220 doing? 52% can read at grade level.
Okay, it's better.
46% can do math at grade level.
Mm-hmm.
73% Asian students read at grade level. 55% for white, 25% for Hispanic, 29% for black. 95% graduation rate, 100% of teachers rated excellent or proficient, and barely half of the students can read at grade level. I mean, spin the wheel, pick a suburban district. It doesn't get any better. How are you feeling? These great schools you think you are sending your kids to, you think form the foundation of your communities. Yeah, no negative word shall be spoken. Elmhurst. 53% of students can read at grade level. District 205, Elmhurst. 49% can do math at grade level. 92% graduate, 99.2% of teachers are rated excellent or proficient, and again, a little more than half can read at grade level. I haven't even gone to the spending, but for example, in 205, property tax revenue, so property taxes, 2010 versus 2021. Over the last decade, what's happened? Property tax revenue has gone up 49%. Student enrollment has gone up 1%. Median home value has gone up 18%. So property taxes have increased two and a half times, a little bit more, than the rate of home value increase. And that's why, by the way, they're linked. Operational spending per student, 30% higher, real dollars. And again, Illinois, we don't spend enough. Illinois, total federal and state spending in Illinois as compared to our Midwest neighbors, we're number one by a good margin. Illinois, it's $17,300. Michigan, it's 13. Wisconsin, it's 12. Iowa, it's 12. Kentucky, it's 11. Missouri, it's 11. Indiana, it's 11, round numbers. Spending more, property taxes, eating away at home value, student enrollment flat. All the teachers are great. All the kids graduate, you know, by and large. And half are prepared to do next level coursework because they can't read at grade level or do math at grade level in high school. And of course, this is a continuation of what they couldn't do in grade school.
Right. But they keep passing them along because they have to, you know, do the Brandon Johnson way. You know, just move them along. Doesn't matter.
And nobody finds this astounding. And no, there's no revolts afoot.
And, well, people move to the suburbs because of the schools. I mean,
I know, but they don't know what they're moving to the suburbs for an idea about the schools that isn't borne out by the evidence. And so is this sort of like what we were talking about? Hey, it's big city living. Hey, that's suburban living.
Yeah.
Well. Whatever the schools do, they do. However the kids, whatever kind of kids the education kids have access to, that's what it is. That's just suburban living. Half the kids can't read or do math at grade level or more in many cases. And all the talk about equity and focus on minority students. How you doing by those minority students? Terribly. Except for Asian students in these districts. Explain the value to me. I want to understand. No. I know. Let's just blame shift. Point fingers. Yeah, it's what's happening at home. Oh, it's what's happening at school. It's this one. It's that one. So that we can just keep it all the same. We just maintain stasis here, right? Not my fault. Nobody's fault. It just happens.
I mean, Chicago, God, it's 6%, 11% among black students.
I mean,
CBS.
it's astounding.
I know. Nobody cares. Nobody cares.
Chris in Elmwood Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. I was wondering if you could tell me, do you know anybody that's running on the school board in the Park Ridge School District?
I do.
Okay.
I do, actually. Let me see. For D64, the elementary.
Yes.
Brian Mercado, Francine D'Amico, Monica Penska Rossi. So Rossi, D'Amico, Mercado.
Okay.
I know that one.
All right. And about 207?
I don't have a recommendation for 207 handy. We'll work on that.
Okay.
Yeah, and if anybody out there...
Do you have like a website, Dan, that people can go to who you recommend?
I haven't done that, Chris, in part because I don't want like somebody to take the cheat sheet or the screenshot and then the other side, these Marxist monsters. School board members, and use it and say, oh, these are Dan Proft candidates. Oh, it's conservatives and blah, blah, blah. Oh. You know, I people want my support, that's fine. But if they don't, they just want to stay out of the politics and not, you know, be polluted with my brand or whatever, then I don't want to impose it on them either. I'm just saying these are candidates I recommend. There are other people recommending them. You know, whatever. Take it or leave it. It's fine by me.
Okay.
Thank you so much, and you do a great job. Thanks, God bless
Chris.
You.
Appreciate it. Susan in Geneva.
Hi, Dan. How are you? This is Susan Hathaway Altman. Nice to talk to you again. I am recommending two folks for candidates for the Geneva School Board, both with level heads, very conservative and caring about actual academics, and that's Brittany Quinn Sobchak and Andrea Hieg. Andrea actually ran against me, if you remember, for the Congress race back in 2022.
All right.
But, you know, it's funny. I just looked up the slogan for Geneva 304 because I had kind of forgotten it, something about a tradition of academic excellence, and I believe that was what it was. It looks like they changed it to just a tradition of excellence. I could be wrong, but I think they took the academic out of it. I'm not kidding.
At least they're being honest.
I'm not kidding.
We're just sort of generally excellent. Academics, not so much, but just generally. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I could be wrong about that, but I thought it said academic excellence last week. They're focused on a lot of social issues versus academics, and I don't know
it
about
shows.
You, but I know I send my kid to school to learn academics, math, English, science, etc. I can teach them the social issues at home. We have some of the highest taxes in Illinois and in the country, in Geneva. We were in the top 40s in school districts in Illinois in 2016. We're now at number 193.
Wow.
Our math scores have plummeted. The proficiency scores were up about almost 91% in 2010. They're all the way down under 40% today. And reading is even worse. So reading was at about 90, and we're under 40%. We're about 39-38% for reading. So it does not make – I've moved here from the city of Chicago. I love the city of Chicago. I'm originally from Pennsylvania. But I moved here because I didn't want to continue to put my kids in private school to learn academics. Because they weren't getting, you know, some of the other facilities. You know how Catholic schools are. Sometimes they're underfunded, right? So I moved out here to give my kid both kids a very great, excellent education, and I'm very disappointed.
Thanks for the call.
Things just keep. Thank you. You're welcome. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Susan. Appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, that's just like you have. If you're looking around, you have to see what these numbers are telling you is happening, right? Robert Villa Park. Hi,
just wanted to I wanted to mention Patrick Gong. He's a conservative candidate running for District 45 in Villa Park. His website is Patrick Gong, G-O-N-G, for D45.com. If you want to check him out, he is a write-in candidate, so we hope to get him written in for
In D45
upcoming election.
In D45, I have Gong and Klemecki. Carol Klemecki, too?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Robert. All right. Patrick Gong, Carol Klemecki in Villa Park, D45. Bob, Lake in the Hills.
Hey, Dan and Amy. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I am running for the board in D300 in Algonquin, and, you know, all the support that I can get would be greatly appreciated. I am also running with Christina Constanti and Connie Kane, three very conservative, very hardworking parents. I was at the board meeting last night in D300, and they were gaslighting so hard, patting themselves on the back to how well the school district is doing, when at the end of the day, our graduation rate is at 96%, but our students can read at 27% at grade level, and math is at 25%. I mean, it's just crazy.
Thanks for the call, Bob. And that's also where that former assistant superintendent, school board chairman Scarpino, who ridiculed a woman with a special needs kid about mask wearing. He's just awful.
Ridiculed her instead of, you're doing this to, you know, get on nightly or to get on the 10 o'clock news.
Exactly. It's a complete disgrace. That needs an overhaul there. I wanted to also mention in Lincoln Way 210, two candidates, Gina Sambo and Nate Sandoval, Lincoln Way 210 down in Will County. Mike in Oswego.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Just wondering if you have recommendations for Oswego School District 308.
I do. Hold on.
Dan's doing all the clerical work today, people.
Yeah, I've got all kinds of, you know, shards of paper and things. Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah.
Post-its everywhere. Yes.
The Oswego 308. Heather Grieger, Joanne Johnson, Kevin Johnson, Richard Gilmore. So Gilmore, Johnson & Johnson, and Grigar.
There you go. Johnson & Johnson.
Oswego DU308. That's easy enough to remember.
Gilmore, Johnson.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.